plastic stuff run through here. This is tape number two, side number one, with Ralph Mackey on June 27, 1994, with the interview continuing at his home at 572 West Division Street in Ishpeming. And my name is Mary Tippett Andes. And where we finished at the end of the first tape, you had just gotten out of the Merchant Marine, and you were coming back to Cleveland Cliffs to apply to get back in with the company. So let's pick up from there.
Well, I went to Brick Sundberg, and just about, I was home maybe for a couple weeks, and he asked me if he could release from the Merchant Marine. I said, yeah, I got my discharge. And he said, where do you want to go to work? I said, well, I work for Joe Heller at the Lloyd, so he's at the Mathery, and so I'll go to the Mathery. Right away, the next day I was working. I didn't even get examined or anything until a week after. Mm-hmm. So, back in the old mining game again. Well, I wasn't too long there. Was what they call a company called Miner. And there was no time I was back mining right away because everything was, but I was in a developing crew in the rock drift. So I was, what, 12 years in rock drift alone, just bringing in the main drifts. And that was quite a job. It was not a job, but you had to have running shoes on to make sure you got so much work done in one day to make any money, and we made money. First we had what they call a five-man crew. And we made so much money, so much footage, one half, they cut one man out of there. So we only four-man crew. And we still ponied out just as much. Not too smart up here, you know. But we were all a bunch of guys that were on the route in there. And we ended up, in the end, we only had three men. And first, I was a lead man with five men, then four men, and then I'm with three men. And I got the, what they call the hell from both sides. Miners over there. They're the big wheels. But anyway, I enjoyed that work. I figured I was in rock too long, so finally, every time I'd ask Captain Jelt at the time, I started with Captain Anderson, and Captain Jelt, he says, no, he stuttered, and he'd say, no, you got to stay in here. I says, I don't really have to stay in here, you know. So finally, after 12 years, because me and him didn't click too good in a way, and because he was one of those, they say when a Finlander gets a job like that, he gets, it really goes into his head. That's, well, I hate to say that, but anyway, I had to say it. So Johnny Byrne was, there was two captains, and Johnny Byrne, he's open on a vacation, so Johnny Byrne comes in. I said, Johnny, don't you think I've been in rock drifts long enough? I said, I've been waiting for you to say that a long time ago. He said, you can get out tomorrow if you want to. So I went back ore mining then, and stope mining, but rock drift, you got to know the guys. You have many, many different partners, and you got to go. You're just like a family. Everything clockwork. Everything knew what to do. You know, just right. And you had to make a good blast every day. You know, to make any money, and we made it.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you a couple of questions. You mentioned footage. You mentioned company count. Can you define those for me, please?
Company count is a guy that you're just a spare miner. That's they can put you any place. Maybe a guy's home from one contract, you go in there and fill in, or another contract you fill in, or they can go and put you repairing someplace. It's a base pay of a miner, always what they call a company account. And What was the other question?
Footage.
Footage. Oh, in Ron's place, you got paid by the foot. So many, every half, what they went 15 days, every 15 days, they'd come and measure you, how many feet you had, and then they put a mark where they left on next time again, and measure again. We were making really good footage, and they were satisfied too.
So, when you were doing rock drifting, would you get company count plus footage?
Yes. There's certain things, if you had a breakdown or anything, then hours you're involved, you get company count pay. But the other hours, when you were actually mining, that's when you got the footage pay. But they combine the two then, that you weren't out of it completely. Sometimes you get a breakdown maybe 2-3 days, or something happened like that. Then sets were knocked down, 17 sets I told you about before. That was all company count work. Otherwise, if we had any footage, well, so that's the way that works.
Who would do the measuring? The shift boss would do the measuring?
Yeah, the shift boss mostly. Or what they call the second captain. Second captain would do that.
Were you given a set amount of footage that you were expected to make, or did they
No, there was no set amount, but they knew what was going on all the time because I had a report every night to the boss or chef what's for the next shift or whatever. Well, if there was any delay of any kind, well, I'd say, well, we had a breakdown and we had so many hours. Well, then they mark it in the book, so many hours of company count, see. And if you did that, your footage wouldn't pay for it. But sometimes you can go a whole half, you know, without any breakdowns or anything, and then you made a little more money then.
I want to go back to when you started with a crew of five guys. And you really had it down like clockwork. And then, were you making too much progress? Is that why they?
I think so. That's my opinion about it. Because then they took one man out. But see, we had a jumbo, where it was four machines on it. What they call a jumbo. And four machines. You had a man on each machine, and then you had one was changing bits. Memnades. But when they came with a carbide bit, they didn't need that man either. That was another thing there. I could say that. Maybe that's why they got rid of the guy. Well, the carbide bit would go. But when they had just a plain old bit there, you know, you go maybe 2 feet, you had to change a bit, pull them out, took time, see. But when they come along with the carbide bit, well, they had. Came up with a new jumbo, only three machines on it. That's when we still had four men, but then they got out that fourth man too, or fourth man, and there was only three men left.
And so the machines.
We still got that much footage on it. So
I don't know. Must have been all fins, huh?
Well, no, they weren't all fins, but it seems that I never really had a bad worker in that. They knew it. And some of the guys were big drinkers too, and they were sick, and they do their work, you know. And the money was there if you just got the footage. That's the main thing. Mm-hmm. But they were kind of strict about being in line and everything. Make sure you drop your line. Well, I was always sure of that, you know, to make sure the trips don't go off base, you know. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So,
let me ask you a couple of questions. A jumbo with three machines on it, those were drilling machines?
Yeah. And everything was hydraulic. We raised up and down, and the four machine jumbos, they were bigger machines, and you had to crank everything up, you know. You had to crank them and move them. But these were all hydraulics, and they lift up that machine and, you know, the whole arm and everything. So, but then everyone knew how, what holes to drill and how to drill them, where to drill them, and most of a lot of us brought some naked drift, and then we had to put steel struts afterwards, you know. The little rock wasn't too good, so we had to put struts up. And hey, by golly, you had to get that the whole side holes, especially enough to make sure you had enough for that steel set and everything. So, and you gotta, it was all electric blasting too, you know, and sometimes you gotta make sure you don't get any missholes. But you can't count electric blasts, and they go off so fast. But when you start loading with the Conway loader, you know, you're loading, there's no hand marking, you know, your load out. Sometimes you'll know if there's a bottom hole, they'll go off well. And you recharge it and set it off. And very seldom, though, electric blast is pretty good.
What's a Conway?
A what?
Conway.
Conway loader. Oh, that's the name of the loader that is a one man runs it. You got a bucket. You go into the dirt pile and lifts it up, and then a conveyor belt on the back, and then you got a car back there and load the car. When the car gets full, you got one of the guys there, one on the motor, and they go and switch another car, and by that time you're cleaning up the sides and whatever, you know. But we get one guy, we had turns running the loader, but then we had one guy that used to cry when he used to get on it. He used to reach those brands until they were burning, you know, they were smoking and everything. I said, hey, Ted, I said, don't burn those bands up, you know. And he'd get so tired with his arm, and I could go with one hand, and the two didn't just, that Conway loader wasn't going to take so much dirt and up with it, you know. But he thinks he was going to take the whole pile. Well, that things happen that way. But hey, we let him run it. Mm-hmm. That would kill time, you know, and it was taking too much time.
Yeah. And of course, time was money, huh?
You better believe it. That's what they call it. We got running shoes. You didn't have them big boots, you had them small boots on, only, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So. Yeah, and many times we'd be right the last minute coming out, and then we always had our own motor, and the cage was there, run to the cage, and but I kept us in shape too.
I want to ask you about, and you don't have to answer this if you don't want to. You don't have to answer anything if you don't want to. But you mentioned that some of the guys were drinkers, and they would come to work and they'd be sick. Was it pretty common for a lot of the guys to drink, or was it just a few of the guys, or what proportion would you say?
Well, everyone, any miner, if it was actual miner, he'd drink. Not excessive. I never drank excessively. Mm-hmm. Just when they go out, maybe have a few, but but some of them were addicted to it. Mm-hmm. And I got a partner, he's living today, and he was the best partner I ever had, you know, and a very comical guy, and we had a lot of fun and working together, and he'd seen him throw up so many times, but he kept pounding away on that machine, and whatever he had to do, he did it. Like one time I was under a loader, you had to get in under to tighten the bands, you know, to make sure they work right, so the nut had that dropped off. I says, hey Turk, his nickname was Turk, and go get me one of them hexagon nuts off the motor there, you know, there's only one size anyway. Oh, he said, you want one of them Antonagon nuts. Comical guy. Yeah, so. Oh, that was you had to have fun down there too, you know. I don't care if men are men, but they're kids too sometimes, you know. And a lot of times I noticed, getting back to the Lloyd for a second or two here now, and
they used to, on the motors, they used to tie up each, everyone's jacket, put the sleeves inside out and haywire them and everything. And this Sparky Corpy tied up, was tying his jacket, took him all morning to tie up the jacket. Come to find out it was his own jacket. Oh, talking about that. Well, that's the way it goes.
What other kinds of practical jokes were, do you remember? Were there things that were commonly done, or was there somebody that was real creative with practical jokes underground?
Well, I could think a lot about something, but it'd be a little on the dirty side, so I'm not going to say anything. But then there was always this story about them two cousin Jacks, you know, and this cousin Jack asked the other one, he said, "What time is it, Jan?" Jan pulled out his watch. He says, "There she is." The other one looked at it. He says, "Damn if she ain't." That's your cousin Jack joke.
Mm-hmm.
But like in Lloyd mine too, talking about there's Italians, Finns, cousin Jacks, Frenchmen, everyone working there. There was a cousin Jack and an Italian working together. Well, they couldn't understand each other, but they knew enough Finn, both of them, they talked Finn. They knew what was going on in the Finnish language. Well, that's years ago. A lot of them guys could really talk, get that Finnish language good, you know. So, but then again, there were a lot of times you'd get a scraper man in your contract way, especially when you're caving, and you come back, he's sound asleep behind that tugger, no dirt, and you take some fuses and you tie them up, you know, time recorder, whatever, and they sound asleep, and pretty soon they can... They might have little things that you had fun with.
We pause tape momentarily, and my question for Mr. Mackey is to describe the concussion that you might feel when a blast went off or when a large body of ore would cave.
Well, a concussion is something just like a blast of air. Not when they're blasting underground, there's such a concussion from the blast that it just shakes everything, and wherever that air can push, well, it's going to push the air that way. Like two of us were working in a stope one morning at the Lloyd, and we had orders to stay out of the stope because it's dribbling. It was dribbling in the back, you know, something's going to let go. So I said, "Well," asked the boss, "what are you going to do?" He said, "Well, down below your stope, there's some dogress that you can go in there and drill and push them ahead." And all of a sudden that stope left go. It pushed us right against the, what they call the breast, where we were going to drill a cup ahead. And by golly, we both jammed in there together. That the wind was so... my partner said, "You go like this." I said, open your mouth. "You can bust your eardrums, you know." So I had my wife, who had enough sense anyway, finally he opened his heart too, you know, that other than to bust your eardrums. But it didn't hurt us anything, because we were in a safe place anyway, but the concussion that came pushed into that dead end dog drift too, you know. So that's what concussion is, that I...
What's a dog drift?
A dog... Well, it's just a small naked drift that you can't even stand up in them. See, about 4 feet wide, 4 feet high, about 3 feet wide, and you drill, especially in a stope. And once you go from, you start opening up into the stope there where you got the opening for down below. And that's all you need is a little dog drift to go in there, so.
And if there's no ore and there's no footage paid, it doesn't make sense to make it very big. Huh?
Well, you got paid for bringing them down to a cent. You got so much a foot for that, too, you know. So then everything was on a footage basis there. But once the ore start coming, well, that's free dirt for them, you know.
Mm-hmm. You said when you were describing the concussion that there was dribbling in the back.
Well, dribbling in the back, that means the, in a stope, you know, what you're doing is you're blasting and hoping it starts coming down, you know. Otherwise, if it don't come down, you keep drilling and blasting, make it wider and wider, and then pretty soon it'll all come. And when that starts dribbling a little bit, something's moving. And by golly, it moved that day. So if we would have been up on top, it would have really pushed us out of there so fast. But that's about 3-4 different times that I got caught in just got out of there in time, you know. That. But that's the chances you take.
Mm-hmm. So at the Mather A, you were at the Mather A for about how long altogether?
Well, about 16 years. And that's when it closed in 1960, and then I went from there to the bunker then.
Okay. So, do you remember anything? Were you there the day that the Mather A closed? Do you remember anything significant about the Mather A closing?
Why it closed?
When it closed. The day
when
that it closed.
1960.
Okay.
And that's when they told all the men they were to transfer them to the Mather B and to the bunker and open pits. And they took every other guy. One went to the Mather, the other one, the next one went to the bunker. Well, I had to go to the bunker. That's what my number came up. So I was there 3 years, and that played out. And that's when they picked me out to go to the welding school. Down 21 weeks in Marquette.
I want to talk a little bit about, before we finish off with the Mather A, other than you mentioned that the sets at the Mather A were steel, the sets at the Lloyd Mine were wood, are there any other significant differences that stand out in your mind between the Lloyd Mine and the Mather A?
Well, they didn't, the steel was too expensive for the Lloyd Mine in the first place. And when they found out they could get steel cheap enough at the Mather A, that's when they started using steel. But they were just in the main drifts. But me and my partner, we put the first drift of steel in the Mather A when I got out of the rock drift. Show you a picture. We started organizing the union in 1930.
Hold on just a second. The next thing we want to get into just a little bit is whether you belong to a union, and you want to just go ahead and tell me about that.
We started organizing the union at the Lloyd, when I was at the Lloyd Mine in 1938. And that time they had organizers come here from the international to get us organized, and there was no problem getting organized. But if you got caught with a union card, you got fired right away, no question about it. So when the company wanted to organize us as a company union. Well, I went to the first meeting. Everyone was just nosy. And who was the main speaker but S.R. Elliott, the manager of the mines around here. Well, they gave us a lot of bull that we thought was a lot of bull. So that was the only meeting that was ever held at the company union. So then
I want to ask you, do you remember any of what they told you at that meeting?
Well, they more or less they bragged us right to the hilt that we were a bunch of good men and good miners and that United Steelworkers Union is trying to get, or the CIO is trying to get in here, and they wanted to discourage us from not joining it. I had a card. A lot of us had the cards. So anyway, After that, when the war started breaking out, we had an election in 1942 or 43, which we voted the union in. Majority of us voted it in. But the company would not recognize us, even if we were organized. But the war broke out then. Lots of the guys went into the war, in the service and everything. When they come back, that's when mine started, and that's when the big strike came out in 1946. That was the first time the company recognized us after we settled that strike. That was the first contract we had from the company. So it took that long before we got in there. And then, to me, as far as union concerned, you got, I always say you got radicals on both sides. You got radicals in the union, you got radicals on the company side. Now, if you got rid of them, all them radicals, labor and the management could get along good. And that's what's been happening lately when we these long, long contracts, you know. You get together. But now you got some new men out to CCI, too. Mr. Moore out here is kind of a radical when they come right to it. My opinion, this is all my own opinion. But the union got some dandies too, I tell you. I was approached many times by the company themselves to get to be a union officer. I says, why? He says, some of the guys you've got at the offices in there won't listen to a thing. They're radical. They're the guys that ain't got no use for the company. They don't want to work or anything. That's what I always say, that you've got radicals. But I still believe in union because it's security. You got hospitalization, you got pension. I worked 10 years for the company before I got a week's vacation in my first 10 years. And now they got vacations, now they got good pensions. I'm on a pension of 1974 contract. I don't get anything extra anymore. So, but I'm satisfied with what I got anyway. But, and that's why I believe in union. And as far as the Barnes and Hecker, I think that was another reason I believe in union. That the men were a dime a dozen them days, you know, they come from the old country and no organization at all. They were just like if they had to go to work, you know. Well, I could talk about that all night too, but... But after that, then we got our 13 weeks vacation, you know. I had about two or three of them. And to me, I went to union meetings, but I was looking for more money, more money, more money. I said, hey, how about let's look for pension rights and more hospitalization? And stuff like that, that's security. Wages, if you get a dollar an hour raise, they're going to raise the prices in town so fast that, and that's what's happening. That's where you get your inflation. But, like I say, I still believe in the union. I belong to the retired steelworkers now. I'm one of the officers there, you know, because we don't have to fight for anything there. But we back up the union. If there's any piece of the pie, what we've been looking lately is make sure that they don't cut our insurances off, because that's what's happening. They're major medical. They were going to cut that out and all these. But we put in a claim in that, but the company don't just throw it in the waste paper basket. But we do it every time anyway. So. I have nothing against the company anymore. Barnes and Hecker, that's a thing of the past. And I worked about 3 months shy of 40 years. So, the one thing, if we would have been on the same wages before 1946 and after I started building this house in 1948, Well, they never built it. The money wasn't there. But that 18 and a half cents started, and then we got a little more raise next time, and we built our own house.
This is tape number two, side number two, of the interview with Ralph Mackey, taking place on June 27th, 1994, at his home. And my name is Mary Andes. And as we finished side one, we were talking about Mr. Mackey's involvement with the union. And my next question is, you mentioned the strike of 1946, and I understand that was a pretty volatile time, and I wonder what you would be willing to share with me about that.
Well, the 1946 strike, I think it could have been settled before it was, but there was enough men that wanted to keep on working, and there was more men that wanted to strike, and I was one of the ones that wanted to strike for the simple reason for a better standard of living. Now, I didn't get too involved in picket. I made put my time on the picket line, but I didn't want no rough stuff at all, but there was a lot of rough stuff. What I did, I went back out in the woods and started cutting logs for a logger. 5 days, and sometimes I wouldn't go back until maybe Tuesday, and then we stayed out right on the camp out there, and then I'd hit the picket line, and then it happened that one day when this party from West Ishman you were talking about came through with a truck, and armored truck, and through a crowd, and there was women, kids, and men, and of course there was tomatoes, eggs, and everything flying. But he came through that crowd that it was lucky that somebody he had killed. Well, they followed him right to his home. And, well, I had to be nosy enough to go up there too, and they wanted to dump his truck over. But, boy, I was dead against that for the simple reason the truck was on a hill, and the house was down there, and there was little kids looking out of the window down there, and if that truck ever went down and hit into that house, well, it would have been a terrible, terrible thing to happen. But that's the time that person came out with a gun, too. So, things like that. Now, I still know the guy. I see the guy once in a while. We say hi to each other. I just was very happy nothing happened that time. But he was one of the guys that wanted to go to work. And then later on, he got fired from the company. And then it was other places where they pulled guns out. And this guy from Nagani, too, he pulled a gun out. And I had a sawed-off shotgun. And he threatened a lot of people with that. And one day there was the superintendent and the captain of the Mather A mine, and parked in town there one place, and then a bunch of guys followed him, and they were going to dump the car over. And they did. And the captain, he stuttered a little bit. He said, no, you can't do that. But they did it. But it was getting out of hand, and it was injunctions, you know, that you had to go to work, and they were going to bust the union, and it was close to being busted. But the men stuck it out, so. Mm-hmm. But the radical part of it, I never did not understand, but I was against it. But this superintendent at the Lloyd or Mather mine that time, well, his father started that big strike in copper country, so there was a little connection there. And that was a terrible thing that happened up there that time when that, you know, them kids got in that. Well,
I want to ask you a little bit about the nobody would tell me the story about West Ishpeming. There was a man with an armored truck. Can you describe that truck for me?
Yeah, that's all they, when they went to work that time, there was about 7-8 guys always. And that's all they did is armor that truck, put big steel bumpers on and a steel frame around and everything, you know. That we call it an armored truck, you know. But I think some of the guys were really sorry afterwards that they even went against him. If they wouldn't have went to work, this would have been settled before that, you know. But that's what you got to do, and you got to go and put the pickets up, and you got to stop them. Mm-hmm. And then the one time when I was home from the Alton Woods that time, two officials, about two bosses, came to my place. And I know them good, and you'd know them good too. One was Mr. Bengry, and Johnny Byrne. And they had a job to do. They went every place. They come to the Ralph. He says, "We would like to have you come back to work." I says, "Work? Why is that? Contract signed? Union contract?" "No, but we're offering you 10 cents an hour. That is, get all the guys back to work. The company wants to give us in." I said, "Come on, Johnny and Ernie." I says, "You ain't going to BS me with that." And they kind of stickered a little bit at that. Me go to work and go to a picket line like that, and I got a family here, they can do anything to my family, in which was something happened. You know, had half a haircut over there. You pull him out of a barber's chair. When he was barber, threw a half a haircut. We called him half a haircut afterwards. And he went to him. And things like that, you know. That. So.
Pretty volatile time.
Well, that's the way they try to break the union, see, mm-hmm. get the men back to work. And
mm-hmm. Let's back up a little bit more. I want to understand why the man who owned the armored truck drove it where he drove it. Was he crossing a picket line, and why were there women and children there?
Well, to tell you the truth, I don't understand why he did that. Because he could have really hurt somebody. But they figured if they had something blocking in the way, he was going to ram into it, and his truck was reinforced in front with big iron, steel iron and bars around there, you know, and that they ain't going to hurt his truck, you know. He figured he put a car in front of him or something like that, you know. That's what I think. But he went through it. Well, a good thing the people backed up, because they were all on the road there that time. There was, I think there was 200 people there mm-hmm. that time.
So the man with the truck was trying to cross the picket line?
Well, they shot out of right from mine, and when he got close there, and he stepped on it. And then he was going in a good clip, I'll tell you. I just happened to be there that day. Mm-hmm.
You said that there were women and children walking the picket line. Was that pretty common in that strike?
Well, not at first it wasn't, but at the end it was when things were getting a little touchy already. Well, then the women and kids were coming in. And women pushed it too, you know. That. But it was a happy day when it finally made the contract. For everybody. But then you had to go back to work, and you're back to work. These guys were working too, and I tell you, the guys sure ignored them for a long time.
Mm-hmm. How long would you guess after the contract was signed and everybody went back to work, how long would you guess it was before people started feeling comfortable with each other again?
Well, I don't think it took too long for the majority of the men, but there were still some that just hated their guts, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think still today some of them do, you know. Yeah, my neighbor over there, what they call half a haircut, well, he
told me, come on. He said, you're getting 10 cents an hour more now. I said, no, no, I'm not going to go to work. Well, let's, they went in a barber shop, and barber shops are all unionized, you know. They went in there and told the barber, he said, you cutting that man's scab's haircut or giving him a haircut? He says, yeah, is he a scab? Yeah. Pushed him out of the chair, half a haircut. He left town afterwards. Yeah.
How long did he stay away?
You mean he never did come back? Oh. He never did come back. He moved out of here. I don't know. Where did they go, Mother? Do you remember?
Dark?
Huh? Yakima? Yeah.
I don't know where they went.
Okay. And then the strike of 46 was how long, and when did it start and when did it end?
It was 104 days. February the 5th. That's when it started. And it went 104 days.
And then at the conclusion of the strike, that was the very first contract that was signed between the union and
the
company?
That was the first time the company recognized the union, and that was the first contract signed by the union and the company.
Were you there when the contract was signed?
No, I wasn't there at that time.
Do you know
when the union don't go, it's just the officials are there, you know.
Do you remember what some of the key points were that the men wanted in the contract?
Well, I was at 18 and a half cents an hour in the first place, and then there was a lot of things ironed out afterwards as far as some vacations and about overtime and whatnot, you know, and there were a lot of things. I don't remember all of that. So.
One thing I'm curious about is with the 18 and a half cents, what would the hourly rate of pay have been then? Approximately. Do you remember what you made at that point?
Oh. I think company count was about between $5 and $6 an hour. Not an hour, a day.
So the 18 and a half cents was to add on to the daily wage, not
yeah.
the hourly wage?
Yeah. Well, all the wages. Well, let's see now. 1940. Yeah. I think they went to about, didn't even go to a dollar a day, or a dollar an hour. A dollar an hour came after that, after the 46 strike. Speaking of making money at the Lloyd Mine, me and my partner, we made $8 a day, and that was high money then. Dollar an hour footage. We had enough footage that. But.
All right. We've digressed to the strike of 46 a little bit. You said that you cut wood to get by during that time. Is that correct?
Yeah, I didn't get that last
one. Did you cut wood to make money during the time of the strike?
Cut wood?
Yeah.
Yes. We were burning wood that in the early years. And cut the winter's wood. But we did get an oil burner that time for the... We lived in up the street here, upstairs in the house. And so that gave us a little more heat.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then we moved from there, we went to Salisbury. We had to have two oil burners going then, and then you had to have your feet up in the air so you won't freeze. Cold house. That's when we started building this house.
During that 3 months that you were on strike, how did you pay your bills during that time? Did you have money saved, or how did you get by?
Well, about a month after, they start giving you, what was that, $10 a week, I think. But you had to be on the picket line for that. And then I went out in the woods and worked. And I can't remember. We made it, eh, Mother?
Yeah,
we
made
it. It was tough.
All right, that kind of took us out of chronological order, because when we Before we picked up with the strike, we were talking about leaving the Mather A in 1960.
Yeah.
And you went to Bunker Hill.
Bunker Hill.
What did you do at Bunker Hill?
Mining. Mostly, drift mining first, and then went to stope mining. And for a while, and then back to drift mining again, and then when it was closing, that's when they start picking the guys to go to the welding school, so they, I got picked to go, and so I took it.
Can you describe what stope mining is?
Well, that was a mention of the Lloyd mine. We had a stope going there, you know. That's where all these dog drifts come in handy, and you start opening up a big hole in there, and you keep blasting until the, what they call the, you say ceiling, I call the back, starts caving itself, you know. Oh, but that's a dangerous business, that kind of stope, open stope. That's the cliff shaft with all open stopes, you know. But that's hard over. That's a different ball game over there. Mm-hmm. But then that, what they call the sub-caving, you know, when you blast and you let the ore itself come down, you know, that there's nothing hanging up there. Oh.
I want to talk a little bit about lunch. What did you bring for lunch? What did you usually bring for lunch? First at the Lloyd mine, then at the Mather A mine.
What I used to like, or well, at the Lloyd mine, I was there. Oh, I was single at the time, and then I got married. Well, we lived. My mother made the lunch pail that time, and then she made. And she made a good lunch pail. That's one thing I can say. She put in plenty of sandwiches, and that time was my favorite was an egg salad sandwich. I love those things, or meatball sandwich, and banana, orange, and these little pies. I don't see them anymore. Cherry pie and peach pies and. That was a little extra always. And thermos coffee. And the Italians always had wine in their thermos bottles. They had their wine.
Was there a particular time of the day or a particular place where the guys would have lunch?
Well, at one time they came up to surface for lunch, you know. But then afterwards that they... You had 20 minutes or half an hour down there but you had to stay down there 8.5 hours underground at first. But then we got that straight 8 hours, and you were allowed 20 minutes or whenever you had a chance to. If you were a miner, you always were blasting. You didn't know when you were going to eat, you know. When you had time to eat, you ate. Oh. There was a... And when, like I say, in the rock drifts, you didn't have time to eat. A lot of times you had brought some sandwiches home even. Or give them to the guys on shaft.
What do you remember that it was like riding the cage at each of the three mines?
Well, if you got in a good place that you didn't get booted too many times or clipped in the ear, and you had a bad habit of getting behind you and clip you in the ear or kicking, and you know, a lot of monkeying around in there, I'll tell you, hooting and hollering, but it was all in fun. One thing I could say underground, all the while I was there, no one got into any real big arguments or fights or anything, you know, that they just got along pretty good.
Mr. Mackey, how long did you work at the Bunker Hill, and then what did you do after that?
I went to the welding school for 21 weeks. There was about 21 guys that were took a course in welding. And from there, I went to the Mather B. I could have went to the pits, but I took the Mather B. And we had to take a test. After we took the course, and there was only three of us passed the test when we got through. I always figured I'm going to learn enough so I can get
if I got a weld, so. So, what happened there, the first day I went to the Mather B, you go underground. I said, oh no, don't tell me I got to go underground again, but I was going to work for Matt Corpy, you know, Matt Corpy. So I got halfway down the tunnel there to a cage, and the guy tapped me on the shoulder. He says, no, you're not going underground. You're going to stay in the shops. You know, it was a master mechanic up there. I didn't know him from Adam, or he didn't know me, you know, but he said, come run down there. He's Ralph Mack, looking for Ralph Mack, you know. So I never did go underground. And I don't know who put the good word in for me or what, but the rest of the guys went underground, whoever went over there. And it wasn't too long. I passed a few tests. I was in 16-point welder, and I welded for the rest of the day until I had about 10 years, maybe 11 years, finished up there. I was 60 years old when I retired. Well, retired, I had to. I had open heart then, so.
You started at the Mather B when?
1964. A little after, about halfway through 64. I guess 65 came up, yeah.
And how long had you been at the Bunker Hill?
About 3 years.
What's a 16-point welder?
16-point welder, that's about the highest class welder you go, CCI pays. Unless you get it to pipe welding, then there's a little couple more points.
Why is it called 16 points?
Well, you start at 6 points, and then you can pass a test, you go to 12 points, and wage scale. It's a wage scale. And at 16 points, that's the best money you can make in welding. So I got to that right away. Or not too long after, anyway.
Based on skill?
Well, I don't know if it was that, but I learned enough at the school, you know. I told my grandson, I said, he went to the Jacobetti for welding school, too. I said, welders are a dime a dozen, but a good welder, there ain't too many of them. By golly, he's a first-class welder. He took everything he got to know at the school, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, but then from there, I start feeling a little punk and went to the doctor. He said, where do you want to go, Marshfield, Mayo's, or Cleveland? I took Marshfield and they did open heart. Went back to work.
What year was that?
1975.
So you worked all together in mining for about 40 years, you said?
Yeah, well, about 3 months shy of 40 years, all told, for the company. Well, see, my time went on, even if I was in Mercer Marine, that counts as time, too, you know. So there we go, about 2 years there, a year and a half.
So during that 40 years, you saw a lot of different people in a lot of different situations, and you saw a lot of things.
Yeah.
What's the same or different about the people?
Today?
Yeah.
I think today, I think the old tube got a lot to do with it. They ain't so friendly get-togethers anymore. Years ago, we used to always had company and go visiting, and Christmas time we visit everyone. Now we hardly go out of the house anymore. You have the kids come over and that's about it. Well, we still have a family reunion at Christmas Eve, but that's about it. And I think years ago, it was more togetherness for some reason,
mm-hmm.
of all the people.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe I'm not in my later years now, a lot of them are passed away and you just ain't got the same people anymore,
mm-hmm.
so.
What about the way people work and the kinds of things that they expect to get for the work that they do? Have you seen a big change in that?
Oh yeah, especially these kids, they don't come and mow your lawn for nothing anymore either, you know. But like I said, my great grandson Will is ours, and they got strict orders that they don't take any money from us. But sometimes I figure it'd be cheaper if we did pay them, because otherwise, otherwise it costs money too, you know. Well, they get well taken care of anyway.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything else that you think I should have asked you about that you really want to talk about that we didn't cover in any of my questions?
Well, I think we covered just about a lot of different experiences. I don't know if you remember or ever heard of that kid that fell in that mine shaft in Niani. Was it nine, 10-year-old kid? Fell in one of them pits, and they didn't know where the kid was until one of his playmates said that, oh, we were playing by the pit, and he fell in the water. Now, right away, they got the company, and I was one of the guys picked, too, to go over there. And I was at Mathery at the time, and they had to drain that pit first and put two pumps there, and the water was running down the Iron Street in Niani, and there was no kid there, and all of a sudden they noticed a shaft down there, and it was a hole about the size of like that. And the kid had fell right into that hole and down in the shaft. Well, once we got there, we had to do a little repairing on the shaft and fix the ladders and the pumps. They only pump about 12 feet at a time, and they push a mile, but only pump 12 feet. And you had to lower the pumps every time they got. And then repair everything down, and then a lot of them had long poles with fish hooks on them and reach down, but it was on an incline, the shaft. And beautiful timber work and everything, but of course there was a lot of repair work to be done. But one night I noticed there was something down there, and I finally got a hold of it, and it looked just like that kid, you know. And I pulled it up, it was a stump. The last night, there was 14 nights, I was on night shift on there, 14 nights. They were going to give it up. They said, the kid ain't down there. I found his sailor cap down there. So I brought it up, and one of the officials who happened to be there and says, hey, he's down there all right. Here's his sailor cap. His initials are on there and everything. And that same day, they got a diver to go down there. And at the cold water, it was going south. The body was going down every time, but it would hang in the timbers, you know, and wouldn't come up. Kind of shafty on an angle. They found the kid about 30 feet down there. We were down 120 feet in that shaft already, so. And then they worried about the old stopes coming in and methane gas and whatnot, and it was a little tricky down there. People were all night there waiting, hoping that we'd find them. They had big lamps down or spotlights down there. But that was one of the experiences I was on. And
what year was that? Do you remember?
Can you remember what year that was, Mother?
No.
It was about 1850, early 1950s, I think. Mm-hmm. It was it related to her too, the kid. Mm-hmm. What would it be? The Rico.
Second cousin.
The father owns Lafreniere's store down there. Mm-hmm. Lafreniere, he's the father.
Mm-hmm.
A company paid the funeral expenses, and I guess about $3,000 for that too, you know. So.
Do you know which mine that caving ground would have been on top of?
Yeah, I have no idea what mine that would have been. They didn't even find maps of it anymore, you know. It was an old one anyway. It was right by the You know, well, there used to be an ice rink there right on the, that's all closed off that property now. Mm. And there's one of them pits, but there was a fence around there, but they fell, slid down in the, and then there was all kinds of junk down there first before you got to the shaft. There was washing machine, there were people throwing everything in there. How he went through to that hole like that, it's really unbelievable.
Well, that's the end of tape 2, side 2, so we'll stop for tonight.